You see, Monsieur Foy? All these people watching so intently, all trying to mask their fears, all wondering possibly if one of the men to be executed has betrayed them in some way, all guilty of some act, some indiscretion, something treasonable perhaps they do not remember. I find it most revealing. Not an ideal day for a garden party.
Unfortunate.
You look pale, monsieur. I do hope this does not distress you.
It's something of a shock, sir.
I'm sorry. A demonstration is sometimes necessary. We prefer those who collaborate with us and who receive our favors in return to keep their membership up to date. It's so easy to fall into arrears. And yesterday's friend can so easily become today's enemy. Would you not agree?
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 155 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
Hayden, I hear you've received distressing news about something that's heading for you in the post.
Yes, I've had a dispatch from Amazon, which is absolutely insane. Because you may have heard for so long, that's like since the beginning of the collections coming out, I've decried them as being crap when it comes to meeting their pre-order dates. Whereas this time with Galaxy 4, I'm getting it early. I'm getting it tomorrow, and it doesn't come out until Monday.
Oh, no!
Can't win them all.
Oh, dear.
So the bad luck continues, lads.
Have you considered hiding behind the sofa so when the postman knocks on the door?
Is that what they mean about hiding behind the sofa with Doctor Who?
Yeah.
I've done my two 10K races now. I've got my open mic night tomorrow as we record. And then after that, it's kind of downtime until Christmas. So I'll have a chance to indulge upon it.
Christmas always seems to come earlier every year, doesn't it? I've already finished our annual Christmas gold run preparations. And I'm usually not got that done until the very last minute.
Oh, it's funny you should say that, Doc, because I've got our festive Who Said What quiz done as well.
And I've already started panicking over what sort of baffling quiz I'm going to come up with. I'm no clearer to an idea, but I'm definitely in full panic over it already.
You just need to buy a battered old Doctor Who quiz book and then just ask us questions about it.
What about another run of Play Your Car Leds Right? Because I enjoyed that last time. Or we can play that game where everyone's attractive.
I think probably with the Play Your Car Leds Right is that nothing anyone ever understands what's going on. So not any of us.
I thought it was very clear. I don't know. What's happened to my Bruce? What's happened to Brucey?
We've had some losses, haven't we, in the last week?
Yes, we have, yeah.
Bob Baker has died. One of the two Bristol boys with Dave Martin, who wrote for Doctor Who between the 70s. What did he write? Claws of Axos, Mutants, Three Doctors.
Yeah.
Suntan Experiment, Hand of Fear, Invisible Enemy, Underworld, Armageddon Factor, Nightmare of Eden.
Yay!
All the classics. I don't need any more Doctor Who hate now, but anyway.
I love Nightmare of Eden, not surprisingly.
And the guys who invented the Doctor's dog K9. Did you also later in life go on to write for Wallace and Gromit?
Do you know what? I did not know that, genuinely, until I saw a rather touching illustration someone had done of Gromit and K9 circling each other on Twitter.
Yes, that was quite nice, wasn't it?
And I thought, no, that's not, is it? And I guess it was. Crazy.
Circling each other is a very polite way of saying they were sniffing each other's arses.
Well,
sniffing each other's antennae. But Mark and I have had a far more shocking loss.
Was it the 20 quid on Galaxy 4?
No. In that Clifford Rose has died.
Yes.
At the age of 92. Computer, he did appear in Doctor Who, so could we have a more appropriate funeral march, please? That's better.
What an amazing actor. I mean, I enjoy his performance in Warrior's Gate, but obviously he's best known probably for Kessler in Secret Army, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And what a masterful performance that is. It's just some of the finest acting to be able to bring sympathy to such an evil character. I mean, obviously, some of that goes down to the writing, but his performance, it was odd. I remember watching it with you, Doc, and sometimes those weird episodes where you find yourself sympathising with him, because the performance is just, he seems like such a normal human being, that in certain stories when bad things are happening to him and he's having troubles with his love life, can't help but feel sorry for him, yet he's absolutely despicable human being.
When I was a kid, Warrior's Gate was one of the only late Tom Baker stories I had on video, and I thought it was a really nasty piece of work in it, not only because he played obviously the main villain, but because he beats the Doctor up at the end. And I remember being quite surprised at that, because the Fourth Doctor always seems such a strong and formidable Doctor, and rather physically imposing, and he's got this bloke with silver hair beating the crap out of him. But it's his last line, you know, that run, Doctor, scurry off back to your blue box.
Run, Doctor. Scurry off back to your blue box. You're like all the rest. Lizards when there's a man's work to be done. I'm sick of your kind. Faint-hearted, do-nothing, lily-livered dead weights. This is the end for all of you. I'm finally getting something done.
I don't know, that was such a good sort of end to his role, I suppose. I remember that being quite memorable. After that, the spaceship explodes, doesn't it? As the gate explodes, so it's a good one.
What will happen to me?
What would you like to happen to you?
To be executed.
Being guilty of what?
The most dangerous offense. Political naivety.
I do not think you understand, Minister. You will not be executed or anything else.
But you said the penalty
can be death, not will be. No, your value to us is in being alive. For the 6 months or so you are spared. You will die like a good national socialist in harness.
I shall publicly proclaim my apostasy.
No one will print it.
I shall decline to attend any government meetings.
It will be announced you are ill, as you are. Mynheer van Rijn, you accuse yourself of political naivety for believing national socialism was the answer to your country's problems. But you are being even more naive in presuming you could change sides in the middle of a war and simply say, I repent the error of my ways and go to a martyr's grave. No, my friend. You chose to ride on the back of a tiger. You cannot dismount when the fancy takes you.
Your victory will be short-lived.
I think not.
Yes, Sturmbannführer Kessler, which apparently I found out today for the first time, translates as Assault Unit Leader, which makes you think, oh, I wonder why he wasn't wearing an eye patch. But there we are. Found a member of the RSC. Died at 92. There we are. And so, on to our review of the first two episodes of the current series of Doctor Who, The Flux. We'll just have to say, faithful listeners, that we'll apologise. If you can hear some noise in the background, it's just the Garm from Terminus, the Warbungle, and Muffet from Battlestar Galactica, who are all having a party to celebrate finally being lifted off the bottom of the list of convincing furry creatures. Keep it down, boys, would you please? Thanks. Now, it turns out that my misgivings on our last podcast weren't proved correct.
Oh.
Flux was not, as I predicted, another word for diarrhea. I checked. And it's actually amoebic dysentery.
Oh, for God's sakes.
We won't do it episode by episode. Let's have a look at just the two episodes combined, if we can. Does anyone want to start us off before I start bitching? Because what, Hayden?
I enjoyed both of them. Is that such a crime, Doc?
No, it's not a crime.
Is that such a bad thing, huh? That you're going to moan about it and you're going to whine at the fact that I really enjoyed it and you didn't?
Yeah, you meme-thirsty snowflake.
How does it feel, huh, that I'm just that little bit more alive than you are? Yeah, huh. I mean, girl.
Mad ass. You mean Mardy, Hayden?
It wasn't without its faults. Mardy, what a northern phrase. No, I enjoyed them for what they were. I couldn't bring myself to watch them a second time, mainly because I physically couldn't bring myself to watch them a second time, to go back in and do a bit more of a deep dive, because nowadays my daytime schedule is filled with Teletubbies, Bing, and Mr. Tumble the Clown.
Well, that's personal growth.
I was going to say.
Wow.
And when that's not on, he's got to look after his son as well. So you did manage to see it twice, Hayden?
I didn't manage to see them twice, either of them.
I envy you.
I saw The Halloween Apocalypse 3 times because I watched it once by myself and couldn't work out what was going on, partly due to the sound.
Yes, I've heard lots of people
say
that.
That whole bit at the start, I could only make out about 50% of the dialogue. And I realised when I watched it the third time round with subtitles that that's because a lot of the dialogue isn't quite structured in the way you'd expect it to be. So when you're listening to it, and when you can't quite make out words, your brain's trying to find substitute words and put it into normal sentence structures that you'd understand. And it wasn't possible to do that. There was too many odd pauses and they were saying too many weird things. It took me ages, I think, before I heard the word Lupari. I couldn't work out almost anything that Carvanista said, apart from acid something and then my kill discs. So I watched it once by myself, not understanding what was going on, not being able to hear it properly. Then I watched it once with my friend, the Kellys. And then I watched it, then I had to watch it a third time with subtitles so that I could understand the plot. Yeah, so I watched that one 3 times.
Well, the other way around for me. I understood what they were saying at first, then when I saw the actual words in the subtitles, I didn't understand it at all. I don't like watching the subtitles because the whole sentence comes on just a fraction of a second before they start reciting it. And so you lose any... I was going to say you lose any form of comic timing in Doctor Who, but to the extent there is any. But apart from the start, what did you think?
Oh, I just spent most of the time through the first story quite baffled, but intrigued. But basically enjoyed it. I thought it was probably the best opening episode of Chibnall's reign. So it's the top of League of Three.
Yeah, that's true. And, what, even better than Spyfall?
Mrs. K actually said that it was the best Chibnall episode she'd seen at all, or the best Jodie episode she'd seen at all. So we went into the second episode, and on first view, I just really basically enjoyed it and found it quite a fun
exciting. Well, exciting is probably not quite the right word, but yeah, watch. It probably went on a bit too long, but it did leave me intrigued and probably more looking forward to the next episode than I have been since the end of the Jadoon one.
All right.
But I think, like Hayden said, that it's not without its problems, and I think those become even more obvious when you sort of rewatch it and sort of sit down to make notes and things. And it's I think it's always been ever thus, hasn't it? I think we found reviewing the stories has taken a bit of the shine away. I sometimes wonder if we should just watch them once and then review them, as opposed to sitting down and going over them and over them, because they're beautiful looking episodes.
If I don't watch them a second time with a pen and paper, how do I note down all the things I want to bitch about?
Well, quite.
I've got to say, I think for me, it's something I've done since, oh God, it was early on in Jodie's era. I think 3 or 4 episodes in. After that, I just didn't, I haven't gone back to watch them again. And I don't know, because you miss out on bits. Like sometimes you guys will say something, I was like, oh, I didn't see that or hear that. So that's the danger of only watching it once when you are reviewing it for, you know, the listening public. But I didn't enjoy it as much second time round, because I think Doctor Who, for me, I've spoken about this before, but I think it's the power of nostalgia that pulls it through. Like a really terrible story from the 60s, 70s or 80s, it has the advantage of decades worth of you getting over just how terrible it is and then finding stuff that you love about it. This stuff, we're giving it, what, a week or two maximum in an already tainted era for some of us. Doc. So I find it's almost like you got to look at it from a different view, I guess, in that sense. So that's why I only watch it once. Well, it's interesting what you said about subtitles, Mark, because I don't know whether listeners know this or not, but I was diagnosed with being hard of hearing over the summer, and I now wear these. I'm not even going to entertain that one. I'm now wearing these special hearing aids, and I can't watch Doctor Who now without the subtitles for two reasons. One, because I still find the sound mix is still off.
Yeah.
Which is something which has been leveled out the show for years. And secondly, it's like what Mark said, you know, your brain tries to fill in words that you're anticipating are going to be there, but sometimes aren't. And that first scene was a problem for me watching it. I didn't quite know what was going, but it was a problem for me on two things. One was the sound mix, and secondly, it got better during the episode, but the absence of Chibnall's red pen again, where it was just line upon line upon line of exposition about what they're doing there, how they're going to get out of it. I mean, it was a good setup for a scene, you know, a good adventurous start. But the dialogue was like, it was like strolling out into fresh snow only to have someone throw a snowball in your face and completely throw you off. You go, oh, what a lovely, oh no, that's not good.
It's like if, you remember in The Unquiet Dead, where Rose is stepping out into that sort of pristine snow in Cardiff, and she sort of steps out very gingerly. It's as if instead of doing that, she just flung the doors open and pissed out of the doors, didn't she?
I don't think it's that bad, Doc.
That first episode did feel a lot like Chris Chibnall suddenly. I don't know why I've got this obsession with him breaking into my living room and vandalising stuff. listeners to our Timeless Children podcast, I won't remember. But this one was like you were sat at the table and he's come round and he's just emptied half a dozen jigsaws on the table in front of you and gone, ta-da! It's a new picture. Hey, are you working out? And it's like, no, Chris, this is too much all at once. Stop it.
In case, by the way, listeners, in case you're imagining Hayden sitting there with an ear trumpet to each ear, they are actually these little invisible Bluetooth hearing aids. I had two difficult initial reactions to the openings of the first two episodes. In Flux 1, I was immediately put off at that 100-mile-per-hour delivery of exposition, shouted to have to be tried to be heard over the audio effects. First, I didn't even realise until my second watching who it was who was speaking that it was the hairy dog.
Is that right? Because from what I'm hoping, you seem to be handcuffed and footlocked to a gravity bar, which in 79 seconds will release you into the boiling acid ocean directly below, where your bodies will instantly disintegrate. Even if you survive that, which you won't, in 4 minutes' time, the entire planet will be engulfed by a nearby giant red star. Oh, and if you try and escape, my kill distance will blast you to pieces. Meanwhile, I am now far away, travelling towards what will in future be known as the final hours of planet Earth.
And this could potentially work if that's done with some sense of irony. As if he's effectively joking, like Goldfinger saying, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. I'm going to tell you my plan, and then I'm going to kill you. But first of all, it's Jodie and Mandip, so it's delivered slightly flatly. And you can't use a big chunk of exposition as a knowing joke in this era, because that's exactly what this era is. However, having said that, I did have, well, I was going to say high hopes, let's say hope for Flux 2. Because I initially, when the Doctor steps out into the battlefield, I thought she was going to be quite calm and still. And I really liked Harry Secom. I had no idea it was in the Crimean War. I first worried, oh dear, is this going to be another example of being extremely worthy? But that quickly disappeared. But it turns out the Doctor didn't stay still for long. And even when she does, her performance doesn't seem to vary that much. There's an absence of gravitas in this era of Doctor Who. I'm not trying to sound excessively pompous saying that. Perhaps it might be more effective to say there's an absence of bottom. You don't get it from the villains, because the Sontarans, even in their slightly retro look, are still comedy figures, spouting punchlines about massacres and filthy human scum, and all done in that sort of slightly strangulated Dan Starkey voice. You don't get it bottom from the rest of the cast, because the general in this is just another poorly drawn prick. You know, effectively a stereotype. We can't look to this Doctor for gravitas, because, well, the oncoming storm, she ain't, is she? I don't find any authority or presence in her performance. The way that each line she delivers is done in that slightly leaning forward, over-earnest, insistent tone of breathlessness. I've mentioned a few times before how Sylvester changed completely for me in Remembrance when he drops his vision on character and just sat still in the cafe, just gently musing about nothing at all, just about ripples. And I don't think Jodie's Doctor is ever still long enough.
Yeah, I think we picked up on that before, but also there have been exceptions to that, haven't there? Like that scene in The Witchfinders and stuff. So we know that it's there.
Yeah.
It's in the toolkit.
And in Rosa, but then, I mean, we never find out, do we, with Rosa, how much of it was written, but was it really split 50-50 between Chris Chibnall and Mallory Blackman? Or did Mallory Blackman write all the good parts and Chris Chibnall just added in that that strange time-travelling racist? I suspect it's going to be the latter. And I'd rather leave most of this podcast to the two of you, because if you've either got a point of view which is enjoying it, or at least being able to enjoy bits of it and rationalise some of the weaknesses, whereas I genuinely don't like bitching about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't care less whether it puts the listeners off, because we do the podcast to share our own opinions of things, not to...
Don't put that bit out, Doc.
Not to pander to the listeners, but it just seems that my seeming complete inability to get on board with this era. Mm. There's only so many ways in which I can say it. I could just...
Yeah.
That might be, say, five main things, problems I have with this era. What am I going to do? Just, there, like, five categories, and each week I will insert into each category, right, these are all the clunky lines I didn't like. These are all the plot holes I didn't like. Mm. Here are the examples of bad acting I didn't like. It's not going to be interesting. So what I'm going to do is, if you don't mind, let's experiment with the two of you chatting about it.
Yep.
And I will occasionally throw in just a bit of intelligent repartee. How would that be?
Hoots of derision.
Yeah.
The scoffs.
So the strange thing for me about this year, and particularly these last two episodes this year, is that whereas in the classic era of Who, from 1963 to 89, most of us never really cared about people laughing at shaky scenery or dodgy special effects and rubber monsters, because the whole point of Doctor Who is that was more than made up for by good plots, fine scripting, characterisation and acting. Whereas we seem now to have come full, well, if not full circle, then half circle. And now the visuals, the SFX, the cinematography are extraordinarily good. I mean, that the ship ramming into all the others on Liverpool docks at the climax looked breathtaking. And despite the fact it was a little bit Age of Empires, I don't think we've ever seen anything like the two armies running towards each other at the Crimea before. But now I'm finding that I'm having to rely on that for entertainment, because that now takes the place of credible scripts, characters, and acting for me. And that's not enough for me, because if all I need is jazzy special effects, I can watch Star Trek, Star Wars, Dune, any one of a dozen other shows.
Mm.
And the problem is, as soon as it gets reduced to a race for special effects, the BBC will never be able to match their budgets. I think perhaps Chris Chibnall's era has become it's the Marvel movies era of Doctor Who. Amazing in terms of visuals, and not much else really. But you don't want to hear me saying this every week, so just take it for readily, readers, that I've whinged. And now let's hear the lads being reasonable about it.
Can I just say, Doc, that I love the fact that you said, right, now I'm going to take a back seat and then talk for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, is he still going? Sorry, I just went to go and refresh my drink.
I've never done that before. You just did my Baron Samedi laugh. only fools and horses. Fools and horses. I'm losing it. I sometimes think once I eventually hit 45, I think my memory's going to go completely. Carry on, chaps.
I just want to say, yeah, it is a brilliant looking TV show, and that is. But one of the things, like, so I do think it's a very thin veneer that once you start scratching through, you do tend to see massive holes and gaps and so many weird plot holes and stuff. I know I'm always pointing this stuff out, but it's just, you know, I can be saying things that you'd have said more eloquently, Doc. That's the problem. Whereas I could have just sat here quietly and listened to you saying it.
What did you think of the SFX, two of you?
Brilliant on the whole. The only thing I didn't like, which I didn't notice the first time around, only the second time, was the little tiny Carvanista and Dan jumping out the back of the Sontaran spaceship as it crashed.
Yes.
I've heard about that everywhere, but I think I missed it.
That was weird. And I'd say that the makeup on the Sontarans was really good, like from a distance, but they did this weird thing where they suddenly did a real close-up of the Sontaran eyes, and you could clearly see it really showed up the fact that it's human eyes in a mask, and I just wondered why they'd chosen to do that, really, because everything looked great up until that point. I mean, the costumes generally, I think, considering they'd done, you know, on Doctor Who's budget during a lockdown, looks fantastic. Mm. I think Swarm and Azur look amazing. I this strange thing where I want to stroke Azur's head. But no, I think they look great. Even though Swarm left his coat hanger in his jacket before he put it on.
I really enjoyed it. The thing is, oh dear, I don't know whether this is going to work.
We've spoiled it for you already.
I think the trouble is when you've watched it once, I'm still in that sort of very virginal haze of kind of like
honeymoon.
Well, wasn't that wonderful?
First night.
Yeah, it's kind of
like, yeah.
I've just been married and I've had my wedding night and I'm just going on honeymoon, and that's kind of how I feel with this series so far.
I should have shut up and just said something at the end.
I really don't know where to go now with
this. Like the sword of Damocles hanging over you.
Yeah, because now all I want to do is point out the bits I didn't like. And I don't feel like that's a balanced and fair way of looking at it. Because for me, I'll go, I really enjoyed it. But God, this bit really annoyed me. And Christ, this bit. And oh my Lord, don't get me started on this. But I liked it. And it's don't know where to go.
Oh, you are awful, but I like you.
Well, what did you like about it?
Okay, I think you've hit on a plus point. I think it is looking great, and I think it has actually constantly...
Mm.
I think actually pretty much since it's come back in 2015, I think it's looked fantastic.
Yeah.
I think the writing has improved. I think it's been stronger. The trouble was that first episode was such a mess because it's trying to set a lot of things up. And once I got it into my head, I think it's when the Claire character comes up to the Doctor and Yaz goes, "Oh, Doctor, Yaz, oh, we haven't met yet, but we will soon." At that point, I thought, right, well, this is clearly what this is. This is an establishing episode. So I will just accept this for what it is.
I quite enjoyed that bit.
And then I'll go back and I'll think about that episode as a whole after I've seen the whole series. So I kind of let it wash over me. I quite like Dan. I think he seems a nice fella. But his character is incredibly inconsistent with the way that he's been written. And I'm a little bit annoyed at, only because I've got post-traumatic Tottenham disorder. What is it with the Doctor's newfound obsession with Liverpool? What was that about? Oh, I was a ball boy. I threw the ball to Trent. Oh, I was a ball boy. And I'll f*** off. Really?
Yeah, why didn't they turn up outside the London Stadium and go, "Oh, it's the Moyes era. Oh, I've watched that 3-2 that 3-2 defeat of Liverpool 7 times."
It really bothered me that.
Well, I have a view on this, which probably could halve our audience overnight.
I just felt like, why is the Doctor nailing her masts to a football club? And a football club who are divisive as hell as it is. I know they all are, to be honest with you, but if it was Wembley, if she'd have landed, and I know this doesn't fit in with the whole Liverpool rhetoric, but even Everton, should have landed outside of Everton, you know, like Liverpool fans and maybe some Tranmere fans might have been annoyed. But no, Liverpool, and then boasting about, "Oh yeah, I was a ball boy during this," which is it goes back to when, I think you mentioned this, Doc, when I think it was the Spyfall episode where she's going, "Oh, I hope I'm not in a liver again. Oh, why? What are you doing in my liver?" You know, when the Doctor just talked utter nonsense. When was the Doctor a boy, a ball boy, sorry, to throw the ball to Trent Alexander-Arnold? What a load of shit. And it's glorifying a football club who... I've got to admit, since the 2019 Champions League final, I can only wish bad things upon.
Plus, I think it ought to be highly unlikely that the Doctor would be so shallow as to support a big team, particularly one of the Super League Six.
Well, I would say, as someone who's kind of neutral about Liverpool, that to me, the thing that actually irritated me most about it is it felt a bit like his dad dancing, pop culture referencing.
Yes.
Kind of writing coming in again.
Yeah.
Liverpool are one of the biggest teams and stuff. So let's do this whole shtick about the Doctor loving watching Liverpool. And it just felt a bit... That's why I don't like it. It felt a bit icky.
See, when Stephen Moffat did it, talking about Dan Starkey, when Stephen Moffat did the thing about where Strax goes up to Glasgow because he's so excited by warfare, he wants to go to a Glasgow pub crawl. That's slightly self-referential to Scotland, but it's in a sort of a song is slightly self-mocking sort of way, isn't it? It's not I'm going to go to Scotland. That's where the most intelligent people are, or that sort of thing. It's because it's bad at closing time up there in the pubs. But I think I'm not going to name any of these areas, but I think there's certain areas of the country where some of the inhabitants appear fascinated with themselves. But even worse, also believe that the rest of the country shares that fascination.
Mm.
They create myths about themselves and don't realise that the only people who share those myths are themselves and people trying to suck up to them.
Mm.
And this, I think most supporters of football clubs appreciate that as amazing as you may think your own football club is, your rivals hate you and most of the clubs resent you when you're doing well.
Especially when they won a Champions League off the back of a handball that wasn't a handball, and then the rule changed after that f***ing match.
I'm sure you can tell, listeners, that these are purely objective remarks about football. There's no element of bitterness here at all, as far as Mark and I are concerned. But it didn't stop there, did it? Because it feeds straight into Dan in that museum, going on and on about how amazing Liverpool was. And then Lyle's like, "Oh, I'm officially Scouse. And it's so self-referential. It's clearly Chris Chibnall. I don't know. Having one last chance to pander to his neighbours.
I mean, can I just say, I do like the city. I've been there a few times, and I really do like Liverpool, and I liked Dan as well. But I didn't like the jamming of Liverpool Football Club down my throat, because I feel as though I've had enough of that for the last few years. Anyway.
I mean, I support Manchester United, and I like Liverpool as a city, and I don't really have that much problem with Liverpool fans, except as maybe yeah. some slight abstract concept. But there are elements, just so I'm perfectly aware that there are elements of other parts of the country where people need a bit of a knock on the head. You get this thing about cities bigging themselves up by claiming that basic behaviour is unique to themselves. I remember when the Commonwealth Games were held in Glasgow a few years ago, every night the BBC Games coverage would open with a romantic helicopter flyover of the city, with a voiceover by a different Glasgow celeb every night, lauding the city. And one night they had Billy Connolly hailing how much Glasgow liked to burst the ego bubbles of boastful people. And that it was this particular habit that made Glasgow the finest city in the world and Glaswegians the finest people. I just assumed that the irony in that had to be unconscious. But that's not unique to Glasgow. You could say that's about every city in the UK. I was listening to someone abroad a few years ago, commenting that apparently it's a particularly Scottish thing for people to take the piss out of each other. No, it's not. It's all over the country. That might be a particularly British thing. But even if we said that, I'm sure the Aussies would protest. The difference between cities is that most of them are not so conceited as to claim that these things are unique to themselves. You don't find Norwich, Coventry, Bristol, or Aberdeen, or Swansea feeling jealous that, oh, if only we understood this uniquely Scouse concept of humour. The thing is, of course, that the more shamelessly you do it, the more likely the media is to swallow it and spread it around. And I don't think you get the average Scouser, Glaswegian, Geordie, whatever, doing it. Because, in my experience, it's mainly characters in the media who do it. As loath as I am to admit it, I have a number of friends and workmates from Liverpool. We shan't be broadcasting this version of the podcast in Manchester. Who you'd never hear pushing this Scouse religion nonsense. And I know some of them who will, in fact, roll their eyes wearily when they hear it from others.
Oh, I just wanted to say with regards to Dan, again, feels like Chris Chibnall's got his old paint roller out again, hasn't he, to do the finer character details. because he's the salt of the earth, working class northerner, you know, which is fine, but it's such an easy stereotype, really, isn't it? And essentially, Dan's just he's just swapped in for Graham, hasn't he? Because yes. You can't, nearly every line that Dan delivers, you could imagine being said by Graham, except it would be
West Ham.
Yeah, it'd be West Ham.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same character. And I think he's likable enough. And he did get to deliver the best line, which was when he was handed his tiny house. I don't know why lines about houses in Doctor Who make me laugh so much. see my favourite line from Invasion of the Dinosaurs. But yeah, when he's handed his tiny house, he looks at it and says, "I can't live in that." Apologies for the accent.
And you see the next door neighbour on the loo upstairs.
Yes, yes.
That was funny. That was good. I liked that.
You see, those bits were good comedy. But for me, another problem with the sound is Dan sometimes is delivering lines like he's a ventriloquist story. Like he can't quite say his lines like, Got all the gear.
I've not noticed that.
No, it's my ears. Maybe I'll just...
I suppose that the difference with Graham is that... And Hayden, be prepared to leap in front of us and hold Mark off me, would you? Given that he supports a club which is, shall we say, which is less successful than some others, his dialogue, if he kept referring to West Ham, would be a sort of resigned suffering, wouldn't it?
Self-deprecating.
Yeah. Not, oh, how amazing we are.
Look how brilliant we are. Yeah. I think that might be my issue with it, because I think that... Funny, this is... We could spend another 40 minutes talking about football on this, but you know, as Doc will be painfully aware in recent times, no football club is successful for a very long period, really. And after you have been successful, there's only one way to go, and that's down. And then you see everyone else get better around you.
Maybe not everyone, hey?
Oh, and I think that's the thing, and it's that might age this episode badly, actually. Can you imagine in 20 years' time when the collection finally gets around to doing Series 13, there'll be a commentary saying, oh yeah, when I wrote this line about Klopp's Liverpool, little did I know, of course, that the following season they'd get relegated and they haven't been back in the Premier League since, or something like that.
Is it thoughts like that that help you sleep at night, Hayden?
Yeah, anyway, so yeah, oh God, see, this is the, I'm focusing on the negatives too much. I like how Yaz is quite abrasive towards the Doctor, because I feel as though if I was placing my life in somebody's hands, if they weren't being truthful to me about the full picture, about where they were taking me and why, and by the end of it I could end up with a load of stuff drawn all over my face on a plinth, standing in for a statue about to have the whole of time surging through my body, then I'd be angry too that this person wasn't being completely open with me.
Yeah.
So I quite liked that.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the grand old tradition of New Who, Doctor Who companion relationships, really, isn't it? Because they're rarely ever healthy, especially when the companion gets too close to the Doctor. I mean, you know, Graham and Ryan got out ahead of time. I mean, Martha had a kind of happy ending in the end, or at least came out of it a stronger person and seemingly not damaged by it.
Except that she was constantly sulking, wasn't she, about him being on the rebound?
Well, yeah, at the start. So she went through a lot of
but
crap.
He was a dick to her the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. But let's not get sidetracked down that road. That'll save that for the Tennant review. But, you know, but ever since all the stuff that happened with Rose and her, after she got too close to the Doctor, Donna, Bill, Clara, Amy to a degree, yeah. These relationships are never healthy, especially when the companion starts emulating or trying to live up to the Doctor.
Well, having said that, I mean, yeah, there's a difference to getting emotionally close to the Doctor, which is where a lot of those fell down, and just knowing where they were going, you know, in a dangerous mission or whatever, is slightly different for me. I know it does seem as though Yaz does seem to have an infatuation with the Doctor, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Which seems to still be developing.
She's still very puppy-eyed with her, isn't she? And still very kind of...
She is, yeah.
Oh, you know, understandable. But I'd be the same if it was Tom Baker.
Oh, wow. Do you know what? I don't think that leather skirt would have suited you, Mark.
Oh. I'll return it to Amazon then.
Return it to Wish.
Yeah.
Oh God, that'd be amazing.
What, mean a leather skirt?
Do you know what? I'm going to need a minute. No,
I think it's going to be difficult to review the Phlox episodes because the one thing people have been saying is, well, you can't criticise it for lacking cohesion because it's only part of a 6-part story. But the problem with that is that because they're zooming from, oh, here's Dan doing trick or treat, and here's the Doctor, Truggers Yaz here, and here's Claire hiding from the weeping angel, and it's all dup, 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 dup. There isn't that consistency of story too.
No.
And so I think you're forced to pick on little bits and pieces, which may force us to look for criticism.
Yeah, because there is a lot of things that seem to happen at the moment that the justification for it seems to be, well, just because. It's like, why did Dan end up back in Liverpool 3 days after he left? And why are the first two people he meets his mum and dad? And it's like, well, just because. And at the moment, that's the way it feels. It's possible that there's some Chibnall master plan that will make everything clear at the end. Oh, who am I kidding?
I'll tell you what, for ages I was staring at his dad thinking, I recognise you, what do I recognise you from? I knew his mum was from Brookside. She was Jimmy Corkhill's wife. Yes. I can't remember her name in it now. It's annoying. But the dad was the guy in Brookside who dug the body up under the patio.
Oh, really?
The scene when they find the body under the patio, yeah. He's the one who goes, oh, it's a hand. And I recognised who it was. And I thought, oh, blimey, I don't think I've seen him on telly since that. But Dan confused me because Dan was... See, I'm being negative again. I don't know whether I'm doing... I don't think I'm doing well with this, actually.
I'm going to shut up next time.
I don't think it's you, Doc. I think it is literally because... This is so fragmented, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the problem. It might have been a better idea to wait until, you know, the end of the sixth episode and then review it all as one, but I don't think...
I think this is going fine to me. I'm enjoying this.
I feel as though I keep contradicting myself. But anyway, Dan is... I don't know whether this is because this is only a six-part series, a six-part story, in the way of what we used to have.
Hmm.
Or whether he was away from home longer than that, and whether they have had other adventures in between, which I don't think they have. But why is Dan, within the space of an episode, seems to act like an experienced time traveller? And I don't get that. When he's on the ship, he knows how to contact...
Because he's a plucky working class guy who just rolls his sleeves up and gets stuck in.
Yeah, okay, all right, fair enough. Possibly.
I can say a lot of this, there is a lot of things which you can say that the answer to the question that quite often seems just because.
I've just realised why I'm struggling with this. We've never done, because it hasn't been done since the classic era, we've never done parts of a story before, have we, that were greater than two episodes. This to me feels a little bit like we're doing the Armageddon Factor episode 1 and 2. And then we're going to do episode 3 and 4 next week. Do you know what I mean? It feels like we're doing a six-part story. And I think that's where I'm struggling with it, to review it.
Oh, hang on, Hayden. It's nowhere near as good as the Armageddon Factor.
Actually, do you remember a couple of years ago, I actually said that I quite enjoyed that when I revisited the Key to Time season. I quite enjoyed it. Even The Shadow.
Mm.
And Drax as well. Anyway, no, stop it, Hayden.
You see, I think what's interesting here is, I was about to say, so what do we think of the Santarans thing? But I think, well, let's get to the end of the resolution to the plot of... And I'm not saying this to be bitchy, but I'm serious, it just occurred to me. The plot of the Halloween thing. I'm wrecking my brain. I can't remember what the plot was, or what the resolution of it was. I'm just thinking, well, I know they were in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And there was something about trick-or-treating, but what...
Well, that's what I mean, you can't tell, because it's happen? Like...
Oh, it was the flux coming and all the ships, wasn't it? Now, I shouldn't have forgotten that. What did we think of Carvinista?
Oh, I'm not sure. I think his relationship with Dan is clearly being set up. This would be some fairly obvious writing to me, but I imagined that, I mean, obviously Carvinista and Dan set up as like a buddy story. Two guys who don't get along, but then they do, and that they develop a deep and lasting affection and respect for each other. And at one point, I am fully convinced that Carvinista is going to appear to have died doing something heroic to save Dan, probably. But I don't think it will stick. I think he'll have a fake death. That's my prediction with regards to Carvinista.
I reckon Carvinista, or even Dan, is going to be revealed to be the Rani. Or Susan, one of them.
I was confused both times watching the first episode. Both the first times I watched the first episode with how come he's so clearly hell bent on killing the Doctor, and yet he's a good guy, I guess.
What really fucks me was it opens him trying to kill Yaz. Yeah, he breaks down Dan's front door. And then starts threatening him with things like saying, do that or I'll kill you or something. Then we find out his race is genetically, effectively sworn to protect humans. And what?
Hmm.
So why is he trying to kill Yaz? Why is he threatening Dan? It doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, it seems a bizarre. It's one of those things. Do you two watch any Professor Brian Cox stuff on TV?
Occasionally.
The early series about the universe are very good, but the more stuff he does, the more you know that all the wonder and awe depends mostly on how many times he uses a word that rhymes with illions. There's billions and trillions of... And I think 7 billion dogs save planet Earth. I mean, was that whole thing only in purely to get in the line about man's best friend? But the thing is, I don't think they don't convey that. We only saw one talking dog. And anyone can see giant spaceship and replicate it thousands of times. Like the Dalek Parliament. Initially looks impressive, but once you twig, actually it's just a concentric circle of lookalike Daleks replicated outwards. I remember when Stephen Moffat went through a phase where he kept adding hundreds of years to the Doctor's life with a line of script. It was 200 years that he was at Lake Silencio, or whatever. And then the Timeless Children created thousands of previous Doctors. And to me, instead of making things seem millions of times more amazing, it sort of reduces things to something of a banality. The legions of Daleks flooding out of the spaceships in Parting of the Ways worked for me because it was only just complementing a story which in itself worked, and performances which in itself were compelling. Yeah, it was a nice bonus rather than the sole point of interest. But it was interesting. Did you notice, by the way, Hayden, I thought this would interest you more than Mark, that in the background in Carvinus's spaceship, there's a Commodore 64 on one of the control panels?
Do you know, I did not. Honestly, is there?
Marvellous.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll find you a picture of it sometime.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Now, that's cheered him up. It was the 42 to Doomsday boys who noticed the Commodore thing, Hayden. I'll just get the computer to put up a picture. Computer, can you put up that picture that Antipode and friends noticed, please? I assume they know what they're talking about, the boys, because they're into that sort of thing, aren't they?
Yeah, that's a Commodore 64. I used to go to my friend's house and play Bumping Buggies and Tin and Og on it. And Way of the Exploding Fist.
Was Bumping Buggies what you used to play together after you'd finished going on the computer?
I was very amused when Chris Chibnall released that interview of him talking about his the character of Carvinista and saying, there's an actual line from him where he says, well, the idea for Carvinista came from having a dog, which, you know, is the same as back in Classic Who, isn't it, when David Fisher came up with the idea for Erato from having that genital infection.
You just made that up?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes, because Erato is just a huge, swollen green ball sack.
Mom, say something, Mark, because Hayden and I are speechless at the moment.
It seems odd that the Doctor, who has such a close tie with the human race, has never heard of the Lupari species bond with humans before. And how come all the time in the past that humans have had to leave the Earth in their various arcs and things, how come these dogs have never turned up before?
Seems strange, isn't it? I mean, we're supposed to believe that he was a part of the division, aren't we? Carvinista.
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't notice that until I watched it with the subtitles, actually.
I did enjoy the bit where the... it does sound as if we're scraping the bottom of the barrel to find it, isn't it? Where the sort of... throwback to Father's Day, where she's going around the TARDIS and the doors have all disappeared.
Yeah, I love all the weird stuff that's going on with the TARDIS, but I've always liked that. Like, it harks back a little bit to when I watched Legopolis, and I was absolutely fascinated by the weird stuff going on with the TARDIS reappearing inside the TARDIS and then the cloister bell going off. So that was like catnip for me.
So what did we think of the... at War of the Sontarans, generally. I quite liked Harry Seacombe, though. I'm not sure whether it was a sense of relief if it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Do you know what? Talking about replacing words, you know, I thought you just said Harry Seacombe. I genuinely thought you just said Harry Seacombe.
Yes, he did.
Instead of Mary Seacombe. Did you say Harry Seacombe?
Yes, I did. That's all.
I thought you said Harry Seacombe.
I've been doing this joke since the beginning of the podcast. Did you not?
Jesus Christ.
Oh, dear.
What was it Spike Milligan said when he died? He said, when Harry Seacombe died, I'm pleased he went before me because I didn't want him singing at my funeral. So at Spike Milligan's funeral, they played a tape of Harry Seacombe singing. I don't know why Arato tickled me so, but I've only just recovered. War of the Sontarans was great. I gotta say, I really, really enjoyed that one. And yes, I thought Harry Secombe was fantastic. I thought the more sort of harder look of the Sontarans, as opposed to their sort of, how would you describe it?
Little schoolboys running around.
Yeah, sort of comedic. I know they've always been slightly comedic.
Oh, I don't think so, that either Lynx or Stag.
Oh no, Lynx was, but the humour, because as written by Robert Holmes, I think it was more in their pomposity, wasn't it? I mean, that hilarious bit,
yes,
where Lynx
was,
rocks up and plants his little flag and with a little fanfare claiming the earth is hilarious.
I remember when I saw it, I shat myself.
I thought the Doctor was great in this for not having her companions with her as well.
Yes.
I thought having this Mary Seacole there, good. I thought she was much better. And it might actually be one of Jodie Whittaker's strongest episodes. I found she had a bit more... There was exasperation in her character. And I felt like that brought a bit more of a stronger turn from her. Because I do feel as though... Oh my God, I am giving away my 10th Doctor retrospective stuff already. I do feel as though Jodie has kind of based her performance on the 10th Doctor. As I say, this is the most popular one. So I'll watch this and go, oh, I had a cut like that. What's all... And all that bollocks.
If you think we're sounding really miserable and depressing, listeners, listen to our Tennant retrospective in the early new year. You'll think, oh, they were really happy about one sometimes, weren't they?
Well, Jodie had none of that gabbling horse rubbish going on.
I think Jodie's performance in this is better, I think, because she's genuinely up against it. She's lost the TARDIS. Mm. Her two friends have disappeared. And she can't get back to them. She's having to deal with that general who's exactly the sort of person that the Doctor hates. And I think this is a better performance from her because she's she's angry. She's probably scared, the Doctor, because what's going on. And I think, it's a position where the Doctor's kind of cornered a bit, really. And as a supposed pacifist, obviously they hate this senseless slaughter, and maybe that explains why the Doctor did a bit of out of character alien shaming. It was actually basically shaming the Sontarans for their for looking like Sontarans, when she said, put it back on.
That
didn't seem terribly Doctorish to me,
which I have to say, delivered right, might have been a line that would have got a smile from me, but I'm thinking, oh, God. Because I think you got the impression certainly with the Doctor, with Steyr, where the Doctor's taking the mickey, the fourth Doctor, you got the impression that he was actually very wary of them, but he was doing it for a purpose, either he was trying to make them lose control or something, where it just seems to be a jokey line when it's done here. Oh, there we are. I thought I won't talk about
he says going on to talk about it from the back seat.
The whole what did I say when even before Jodie was we heard that Jodie had been cast, I said my only real problem with casting a woman as the Doctor is that I worry that The writing team, which is almost wholly comprised of men, and men who are the sort of men who have become Doctor Who fans, put it that way, the easiest way for them to make the Doctor appear strong would be for them to have a male character alongside and write him as an idiot. Well, I don't think they've done that so much here, but there's regularly, particularly in this Chibnall era, a woman, how do I make a woman look impressive? Oh, I'll set her alongside a man who looks like an idiot. So it should look impressive, but admittedly only by comparison in my story. So Mary Shelley, of all people, to make her look great, they took it by making Lord Byron, of all people, he's written as a prick. Charles Babbage gets written as a bit of a prick to make Ada Lovelace seem impressive. Here, Mary would have been the most engaging character in the story, I think, even without General Logan, but who is, again, written as another prick. I mean, it's so much of a prick that we'd have to believe he would come out with a title like, I have Queen and Country on my side. That is all the help I need.
Have you noticed how the military actually on the whole in New Who have been written as bloodthirsty, one-note morons, basically? There's no sort of... They're very black and white, aren't they? The military is all like, right, well, we'll...
It's the sort of level of student union agitprop, really. I mean, the way that Tennant used to, in the Poisonous Skies on Tar and Tubata, was screaming at that unit colonel who just had a gun in his holster on his belt. The way that, what was Clara's boyfriend called?
Danny Pink.
Danny Pink was doing this whole thing about his resentment against the officer class, which was based on nothing. It also links into the fact, which I've never liked, the fact that they've made the Time Lords evil, haven't they, in New Who? They're the baddies. Whereas I always happen to think the reason the Doctor left Gallifrey is not because they were all wicked, because he was bored. But effectively, you've got them. There's a fairly moral equivalence between them and the Daleks. Why make them baddies? Like, they're worse. They're supposed to be sort of boring and staid. But I think that's because they think... I don't know, I read a very good line, I think last week, which was that if you take a bunch of people who have grown up from childhood thinking that the Doctor is utterly amazing and then give the writing of the Doctor into their hands, they're going to portray him as a god. And so anyone who's against him, I mean, seriously against him, like, or contrary to him, so they have him... acting like that against the military, against Time Lords. And it's that sort of politics that you would expect to have just as you're getting towards the end of your teens, really. And I just find it silly. You wonder how they'd write the Brigadier now, don't you? Well, they'd have him as as some oppressive figure pressing the Doctor. Well, there we are, anyway.
Let's not talk about the Brigadier in New Who. We'll set off people's PTSD.
What do we think of Swarm and Azure? I thought they were a little bit like that godlike couple from the Wet Willies episode. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit, but they're sort of improved upon. They are creepy.
Mm.
They're a cosplayer's nightmare, I reckon, as well. Good luck and well done to anyone who attempts that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, where are you going to get shoulder pads these days?
And I think... they're suitably evil, aren't they?
Well, also, you're going to have to go to bed the night before the Doctor Who convention with one of those grow-your-own-crystals kits on your face.
I rather like them. I think I'm intrigued to see what's going to happen with them. Yeah, let's see.
I can't
say much more because I don't know where they're going to... No. I want to see. I can't wait to see.
I thought the performances by the actors is absolutely spot on. I think the casting's...
What, Swarm and Azure?
Think the costumes, brilliant. Makeup's fantastic. And they really are terribly creepy. And they're in places very Hellraiser-y when Azure appears. Mm. Azure appears in that water where Diane's been taken and says, oh, we're going to have so much fun. It really did remind me of Hellraiser. And also the bit where he renews himself and all the stuff comes out of his face. Probably one of my favourite bits, I think, of the last couple of episodes, I would say.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you anything about the passenger yet. I know he did have his costume brought from Wish, didn't he?
Yes, face
mask. Yes, I heard that.
From Wish. So some eagle-eyed person noticed. Oh, what did we think of Vinda? Apart from, I think it's very clear that Vinda and Yaz appear to fancy each other. I don't suppose we know much about Vinda, really, do we?
You seem that interesting to me, really. Given that his whole dialogue he's got is just moaning into a microphone about how bored he is. Whereas I think RTD would probably have introduced him with just a few lines which would have quickly established some sort of character for him. But there we are.
Well, the bloke who's in the tunnels in 1820...
Yes.
Is he supposed to be an analogue for the audience walking around saying, this is so complex, it's blown my mind?
Because he seemed to disappear very quickly, didn't he? When the baddies turned up. I mean, he's supposed to be a real historical character, isn't he? This guy who went around madly digging endless tunnels around in the hills around Liverpool.
I wonder if the tunnels are... Well, obviously the tunnels are set on Earth, so where they're walking around in on the planet Time, is that the tunnels but at another point in time?
I don't know. I wondered if they were like a time tunnel. I thought maybe it'd be like a time tunnel and he's just walked through it. Because that cat, is it Morrison, was he called? He seems to drift in and then drift out again. And then...
Well, this is what I mean. I think he's walking through his tunnels and sometimes the time changes. So that's why he says the tunnels keep changing. So he's finding himself in these.
Yes.
Which makes me think time is just Earth in another time. Which, to be honest, is not the most original idea, is it? What is this mysterious planet that the characters find themselves on? Surprise, it's Earth!
It's been done so many times. Have you ever read Superman Red Sun at all?
Yes,
the spoiler alert at the end of that. Spoiler alert, listeners, is that basically Krypton is Earth. And like you said, the mysterious planet. That one with the mysterious planet in it. I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah. And all from 55 as well. So it's not even new to Chibnall.
Oh, God. If he's gone and revisited something he did.
I mean, I could be wrong.
Oh, dear. I don't know. I like your theory. And I think it's better than what Chibnall's probably gone for, which will be the bleeding obvious. But yes, we shall have to see with that, I think.
The Moirai and this Temple of Atropos. So occasionally my classical education comes in useful. The Moirai in Greek mythology were the Fates, Clotho, Lachesis and Atropos, who sat in was it in a cave or was that someone else? And one of them, Clotho, I think it was, would spin a thread of someone's lifespan onto a spindle. And then this Lachesis would measure out how long that a thread, you know, how long they were going to live. And then Atropos would have a big pair of scissors or shears at the end, which you'd cut off to end someone's life. So the whole thing is effectively an allegory for editing a podcast. It's clearly something to do with fate and time. So how that quite goes into it, I don't know. Oh, Mark, have you told us what the Kellys thought?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You watched this for the second time with your friends the Kellys, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Mum and the two daughters, who are 7 and 10.
What did they think?
Mum really enjoyed both episodes. Caitlin, the youngest, quite enjoyed the first episode. She was absolutely terrified of the Weeping Angel.
Oh, right.
Having never seen one before at all.
I thought you were going to say of Harry Secombe.
And
well, they are that one of those basic fear things, aren't they?
Yes. But also loved it and can't wait to see them again. But she did get bored because we watched both episodes, not quite back to back. We had we watched an episode of Ghosts in between, just to kind of take a bit of the to lighten the mood a bit. But yeah, she didn't pay a lot of attention towards Son Tyrants. But Eve, the eldest one, loved both episodes, really enjoyed them, and can't wait for next week's.
Have you ever considered it better if the three of us just retire and hand the podcast over to Caitlin and Eve? They'd probably make a far more happier and jollier thing than we do.
It wasn't just me affected by problems with hearing, because Eve was convinced for some time that the Sontarans were actually called Sultanas. Helped by the fact that they do actually look rather like the... What's that brand of Sultana that used to have the claymation adverts?
Oh, the red packaging. Yeah, I can't remember what it's called.
But anyway, yeah. So she's fairly convinced they were called Sultanas and was really hoping that they were shouting, Sultana!
Having criticised Chris Chibnall, though, I must say that I did admire his elegant solution to the potential plot hole of the Sontarans not thinking to have a night shift.
Now, if they're on the same timetable every day, which I bet they are.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Marks out of 10. Oh, let's do each one. Marks out of 10 for the Halloween apocalypse. I would give it a 6.5. Hayden?
Ooh, that's not bad. I would give the Halloween Apocalypse. I'm going to say 7 for now.
Mark?
I would... It's just a bit of a beautiful but slightly bewildering episode. I'd give it 6.5 as well.
Okay, and War of the Sontarans, I would give another 6.5 to. Mark?
I think it's a much more satisfying episode, but massive plot holes, but love the cliffhanger. 7.5.
And Hayden?
3.
Really?
What?
No, I'm joking. I'd go probably 8.5, I'll say for now.
I was going to say, I'd kill you, because I only did 6.5, so I didn't sound like quite the miserable sod. In other words, you did really enjoy it, because, I mean, you can't get much higher than 8.5. I suppose you can have 9, 9.5, and 10, can't you? But, that's really good. Right. Well, until next time. Oh, Uncle Terence. Hello, how are you? Have you brought us some recommendations for how our water companies should behave now that we can't get cleaning chemicals from the European Union?
Yes, it's don't dump sewage into the river.
Uncle Terence, what's this floating down the river towards us?
It's a crap.
Bye-bye, listeners.
Bye.
Bye.
There we are. That was a lovely photo you sent us of William and his baby grow Hayden. He must have so many of them now, including the one with the diddly-dum crest on it. Poor little boy, being in a Spurs baby grow tonight.
Well, I was just about to send it. I was just about to say, that picture I've sent you, that's Sophie ruining his life, not me, by putting him in that tonight, so...
We don't see enough of him in his diddly-dum, I don't think.
Oh, he's grown out of it. He's grown out of it now. That was 3 to 6 months.
Well, and we all...
He's...
Laters.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.